Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another podcast. I'm very excited about this one, and we are joined by Martin from the Insights team. I've been in the industry not as long. I'm a Gen Z. So I graduated 22 September, and then I moved to London. And I haven't worked with too many companies. In my last company, I was there for like close to five years. And I've also never worked at big enterprises. I've always worked at startups. So, you know, the culture at startups is drastically different than cultures at big tech companies. The one I work at right now, Cast AI, we are like 400 something people. My last company was over 100 people, just around 100 people. And I've seen a big difference in how we, you know, review performance, ownership. Obviously, the one thing I've realized is as bigger the company gets, there's a lot more structure to it. Today, we're going to talk about that culture. Today, we're going to talk about what modern companies still get wrong when it comes to feedback and the improvement of the employees. But let's say you're working with your managers, you're mentoring your juniors down the line, you're working with the executive team. And Martin, I'm very excited to talk about this because your company is one of the only companies, correct me if I'm wrong, who is in this niche in the AI ecosystem trying to solve this issue. Super excited, but before we get started, people who don't know you, do you want to give yourself a quick intro? What do you do? And what's a fun fact about you? What do you like to do in your free time?
Sure.
I know we were talking about fashion earlier. So
if fashion. I'm a huge advocate of fashion. So my name is Martin Jackson. I work for a company called Insights. They're a preference and personality company. We've been looking at the way we can apply psychology to the workplace for about 30 years. And I'm part of the innovation team. So my job is to think about the way that we can use that in a new world. And I was lucky enough to start working on a project very recently that I think Canal's had some real excitement about using the tech from. And I'm looking forward to giving you guys a bit of an insight into that as we go through the podcast today.
Cool. So what does that mean? Like when you talk about Insights as a platform, like we want to give the AI boost to the human behavior. What made you even get started with something like that if not many people are doing it on this larger scale? Like, because I mean, you're obviously more experienced than me and you have had a lot of people in your career, different companies. So you might have seen this ick around performance reviews or, you know, how you measure success in an organization. How do you practice empathy within the organization? And then one day you're like, okay, we're going to do this thing in the age of AI. So what led to Insights and why should people care?
Yeah, so for me, the step to Insights came about because of an MBA. I was doing my MBA during COVID and I had this vision. I was really obsessed with the idea of behavioral psychology and about behavioral economics and nudging specifically. And when I started working on my MBA, we were put through a series of these preference and personality type programs to understand more about yourself, to increase your self-awareness. And it made me realize at that point that if I could tailor a nudge in a way that resonated with a person, the impact and the value of that nudge to the person themselves could be hugely powerful. And I kept thinking about that again and again throughout the entirety of my MBA. And then just by a stroke of fortune, I saw that Kevin Dodwell, who's in charge of innovation for Insights, this preference and personality company that had been around for 30 years, done tens of millions of analyses of people and preference. They were looking for people to think about the way they could apply personality and preference tools in a new world, in a digital world. And I was lucky enough to get the role working here on innovation and applied psychology. And that led us to thinking about how we could apply psychology into coaching type experiences, into feedback conversations, into communication, into change. And that's what led to the API that we've been building.
Amazing. And we spoke about, like I mentioned, performance reviews. So when I talk about HR people, and when I talk about one of their main roles is performance reviews and seeing how well the people are working with their teammates, what can be improved. You said you have a background in psychology. Why do people do performance reviews? And do you know the background to it? Like who started it? Is it like 1800s, 1900s, very new?
And I don't know.
Because there's a report by Gallup that says that only around 14% of the people who say that, you know, the performance reviews that they have submitted have actually inspired them to improve. And for me, reviews are all about improvement. seeing what went wrong, how I can improve, getting feedback from others. And that number is quite wild, just 14%, right?
Yeah.
So what is broken here? And is it like the expectations, or is the timing wrong, or what's going on?
Sure. So I don't know when performance reviews started, but I imagine it's about the same time we discovered fire. They'll have been ticking along for the entirety of time. But when they land badly, it's rarely because people aren't trying to improve. It's usually the systems that we're using. We apply systems to measure performance, and that can make actual improvement hard to achieve. So generally, like we were talking about earlier, organizations treat performance like a one-off annual event. We set our goals back in April, and then we work all the way through the year, and we scramble to assess and justify them in Feb, write them up in March, and we tick the box. That structure guarantees surprises, and it builds in defensiveness, and it limits our ability to grow. What's broken more often than not is the feedback loop itself. And again, this is something we've spoken about before. So if expectations are fuzzy for the person that's undergoing the feedback assessment, your review itself will feel arbitrary or maybe even perfunctory. You can't perform against targets that you really can't see. So if the expectations that you've been working to are really only clarified in that singular moment at the end of the year, then it's not development. That's just judgment. That's what it is at the end of the year. And that's why I'm a big believer in continuous check-ins. Short, frequent, every day, every week, every month. And we work in my team, specifically here around innovation, to keep our goals alive. So every morning we talk about the win that we're going to have today and the learn that we had from yesterday and how that relates to our working week. We work to make sure that our expectations of each other are explicit, and we try to reduce those end of year surprises. So in terms of performance reviews, our goal shouldn't be around improved performance. It should be turning things into actual performance, not perceived performance. And we can only do that through coaching and regular alignment and like a genuine human relationship, not by putting together some end of year form.
Okay, that is interesting. I do agree, because if I'm not checking in with my team every week, I mean, obviously that's not nice. But now many people would say that, you know, we already do check-ins with our managers, and the annual check-in is like a company-wide thing that we have to do anyway, because it's not like I'm not checking in with my team. It's just that this annual feedback is a bit different. But then still they're like, I don't see the use of it, or I'm not seeing the ROI. And the other question is like, do you believe in tying everything with OKRs when you're working with teams? Does it matter what the size of the company is? Is it like, if I'm a smaller company, it's like 10 people, we have just started?
So when we talk about it in terms of a large company, the way that we work as a team is about like incremental gains, like every day, every week, every month, every quarter, every half, every year. And if we're building out those incremental gains, we know we're walking towards our targets, and we know that we're building the evidence to prove that we've made them, and we know what we're aiming at. So if we keep orientated towards it, we know we're walking towards that goal. No surprises at the end of the year. No concerns in that performance review. In terms of dealing with different scales and sizes of companies, when I very first started work, I worked for the government. So it was the biggest possible company, except maybe like Amazon or Walmart. It was a very, very big situation. And performance reviews were very much like this. Once a year, get your objectives set. End of year, have you met those objectives? Tick, tick, tick. Have you achieved 80%? Congratulations, you've achieved your year's requirements. But I don't think that's real. I think what we do every day, the check-ins, the working towards something, something where we're all focused and aligned, much more meaningful. And I think that would work in any size organization. I think that individual incremental day, step forward one by one, that's really powerful.
Amazing. Well, Martin, you mentioned that it's not just about performance reviews, a one annual thing, but it's about communication, because we are talking about giving feedback and receiving feedback. But most of the time, you know, it's either too vague or too blunt. I've worked with a lot of people who are very, very nice. But when I was like 21, they would give me very blunt feedback. And I would be like, okay, why is this person being rude to me? You know, but then when I progressed in my career, 2 years, 3 years down the line, I realized, no, they're actually very sweet people and they wanted the best for me. They were just too blunt. And in the end, it did help me improve. So when we talk about meaningful what does that actually mean in real life? And more specifically, you know, if you can give some examples, how people can give good feedback.
Sure. I mean, I've had it described to me that feedback is the breakfast of champions. You want to be great, you need to know what you're going to be doing wrong. And feedback helps with that. I think of meaningful feedback as something you can use or you can do the very next day. It's clear and it's applicable. And I've had it described to me as four quarters of a whole. Specific and observed, it has an impact and it tells you what to do next. Four factors. So when I think about it in terms of being specific, it shouldn't be more thoughtful, but an actual specific example of what happened and why. So less be more thoughtful, more in that meeting, you jump to a solution before we managed to align on the problem. That's specific, that clarity. And next, it's grounded in a real example so people can act on it. It's not vibes, it's real. They can act on an observation. So if we think back to the example of the meeting, we were both there, we both know that happened. It's real. And third, that point we have to link to impact. Because of those actions, you created uncertainty, and uncertainty causes delay. We rush too fast, and that impact is what makes feedback feel fair and make it feel relevant. And lastly, you have to combine the what's next, the to do. So an achievable response or an action or a next step you can take in light of that feedback. Not a vague instruction to be better, but to think more deeply. And that's a layer that we can think upon. So when I think about the most important feedback that I've had, it makes me feel seen and heard and understood. So you show to the person you're talking to that you've understood their context, the constraints that they're operating under, the trade-offs they had to take, the pressures they felt. So feedback can't ignore context as well. And if it ignores context, it'll feel unfair. And unfair feedback triggers defensiveness, and that leads to resistance, which is a real problem. So I like the idea of building a pull system for feedback. Encouraging people to ask for feedback way more often is a great idea. I try to do it with my management team, and it turns feedback into the norm. So instead of it being something you dread at the end of the year, it's something that happens every day, and you don't become immune to it, but you can become comfortable with it. And as I say this, my marketing experience is going to groan as I shine a light on them again. But Patagonia is an absolutely brilliant example of a company leaning into that sort of like continuous employee-driven, ask for feedback, be better yourself culture. They lean on collective feedback from peers and even from customers. There's way less emphasis on those formal ratings and singular one-off events. So yeah, I think that's incredibly powerful. And with that, my fanboy section on Patagonia is over. But to me, that's really meaningful. And meaningful feedback shouldn't be a corporate buzzword. Meaningful feedback is clarity, and it shows you care. And it shows that you've delivered it in a way that the person can actually make use of, and that in of itself is powerful. So working at Insights, I know that people take feedback very, very differently. Some show some real self-awareness. Knowing the preferences of the people around you, it can really help you package and deliver that feedback in a completely purposeful and powerful way, and in a way that you know will land better for the person receiving it, and that makes it more effective for everybody.
That makes sense, because there's proof of work. And if you're saying that you didn't do this right, this is how you could have improved, you can tie it back to like an instance.
It's a chain.
Somewhere in the year, which is interesting, because this is why weekly check-ins or regular check-ins are quite important. And also maybe like keeping a track of the important bits. How do you see people do that? Because if you don't do that, then maybe you have seen someone who performs well, but they still get a bad review, you know, things like that. So my question to you is, and, you know, previously we were talking about OKRs, so defining everything. So what are your thoughts on that, tying everything, you know, around business outcomes? Because in the end, everyone at the company, they're like, how much impact am I making? I mean, it's a business. If you're working at a corporate or whatever, what impact am I making? How do you measure that? But you're in marketing, you're in sales, you're in developer relations, you're an engineer. There's definitely something you can, you know, tie into. And many companies do OKRs. So what are your thoughts on that?
I'm a huge proponent for OKRs. Measure What Matters, John Doerr's book, is somewhere on this bookshelf down here behind me. And it was instrumental in the way that I started to work in my team at Insights. I think clear objectives and key results that underpin them are a really powerful way to show progress and a really powerful way to make clear what the company is trying to achieve at any given time. And you asked me another question around the way in which we track those daily, weekly, monthly feedback points, or those points where we could coach somebody or we could learn. We do monthly retros. I know dev squads are big fans of retros at the end of every sprint. We do them as a team across the entirety of our performance for a month. So at the end of every month, we all get together and it's a peer session. Everybody works together to understand where they won, where they learned, what they'll do better next time. If they want to change their objectives, they want to change what they aspire for, that's the time to do it. And we do that openly as a team, and we can work together to understand those points. I think it's a really powerful way to track it. And it's really light. You just put together a Miro board, keep it in there, update month on month. And again, by the time you come to your end of year, you've got all the data to support everything you want to pin through.
Yeah. I won't name a company, but I saw some of my friends, because you know that you have these surveys, least, neutral, extremely likely, likely. And they were just like, tick, 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 tick. Like, just, they just want to get over it, you know? And the second thing is, one of my friends was like, there's an emotional bit to it as well. Let's say you are friends with your teammate at a company, and you want to be extremely honest, but you also want to overall make them look nice and say, yeah, it was amazing working with them. But then it's not like clear that, you know, there are areas where you are not doing good. So there's that emotional bit to it. When you become friends with people in the industry. I mean, I don't know how different it is with other people. I'm Gen Z. But you know, that's what happens. And in the real world, like, that one sentence of feedback that you give someone, it can either motivate them or it can completely shut them down.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think that's really important as well. I think that's why making it continuous and making it regular and making people have a clear chance to update and inform and make clear, that's really important.
Yeah, I'd agree. And fortunately, I've had amazing managers, you know, throughout my career. But when we talk about managers, what are some of the common habits? Because we're talking about giving some feedback that might feel, you know, motivating or completely shut someone down and, you know, break them down. What's like a habit that you've seen that accidentally, like, I didn't mean that, but it turned into like a fight? Even when the manager was like, I mean well for you. So how can they give constructive criticism better? I think that's the narrowed down question.
Yeah. So no fist fights yet when I've given feedback. But we've certainly had conflict, but we've not got to the point of having a brawl yet. But in terms of delivering those kind of bits of feedback, I've worked really hard on this. I know that I can be too empathetic. I can not be clear sometimes, and I don't make my expectations absolutely crystal. So in order to answer this, I'll focus my own bad habits. Just to make clear, I have good intentions, but I've probably just got poor technique. So I'll tell you about what I've got wrong before and what I try to get right now and what I've learned. The first thing that I got wrong in my very first managerial role 20 years ago was about turning feedback on behavior into identity-focused feedback. So I made those big errors early doors. For example, saying you're difficult to work with sometimes, or your attitude is impacting the team performance, those kind of frames did not go well for me and it ended badly. This type of framing up, it triggers defense in people instantly. You're not talking about work, you're talking about the person, you're judging the person, and that goes south really fast. Don't ever do this. I got that really wrong. The next thing I'd think about would be in terms of ambush feedback. So if somebody hears like it for the first time in that formal review at the end of the year, that's not feedback. You failed. Good feedback shouldn't come with surprises. It's a continuous developmental cycle. And that's what I try to instill within my team. And last, I feel this a bit after I've given you this long, great big long reply, but it's a manager's monologue. If I've been talking for too long and I'm talking too quickly and I'm taking no questions and I'm not really listening to what you're asking me or telling me, even gentle-hearted content, that can feel really harsh and antagonistic if it's delivered in that one-way mechanism. So habits that prevent conflict, they're much simpler than you'd expect. We've spoken about these: short, regular, frequent check-ins, real examples, proper next steps. and trying to build a culture where feedback becomes the norm, not some end of year ceremony.
One point I loved was that it, I agree, but I never thought of it, that it shouldn't feel like a surprise. And that makes, that's like exactly like, right. It shouldn't feel like a surprise. That makes so much sense. Because then it's going to be like, okay, then why didn't you tell me earlier that I wasn't doing well? You know, why are you telling me now at the end of the year? And I could have improved. Makes sense. Do you think it's changed with the, because now you're probably working with people like me, like the Gen Z. Do you think the management style has changed a bit? For example, when I was looking for my first role, number one thing I always care about, for me at least, is, I mean, I'm fortunate enough to be in my career that I've gotten a lot of experience. So I do feel really fortunate for that. And I owe a lot of this to open source. But when I was looking for my first role, again, it was very humbling because I had options to choose from. And that was like pre-COVID era. My main priority was growth, learnings, and how much I like the people in the company. And the reason being, because I was like 21, and I'm like, my main priority is to get as much experience as I can. And that will help me later in my career. And that's what I did. I literally got offers that were like paying twice the amount. I'm not kidding. Twice and sometimes 2.5. But I joined an early on startup because it's an early startup and anything I want to do, I'm like, hey, I want to do this. Mm. Yeah, Kunal, go for it. And in the end, by the time I left, I was building data centers in countries and I was leading countries. I wouldn't have learned that at a huge tech company when I'm in a department, like building data centers, working with the government. Having said that, like obviously working at big tech is amazing for your career as well. You do learn a lot and there's a lot of safety. My sister works at Microsoft. So there's no one right answer. Everyone has a different path and that's the beauty of it. But that's what matters to me. So my number one priority is if I like everyone in the company. You know? If there's even a single company, even if I don't work with them and they don't like me, that's like an ick for me and I would talk to them, okay, what's up? You know, what am I doing wrong? So have you changed the management style when you work with Gen Zs and like, what do they care about more?
Okay, this is really interesting on me. This is a really interesting one for me because generational labels are an ick for me. They're a real bone of contention. So Prince Charles and Ozzy Osbourne, they're both born in the same year. They're both divorced. They both live in castles. They're both wildly wealthy. They're both paid entertainers and they're both very different people. But they're both labeled in exactly the same way. Rest in peace, Ozzy. So what I say here perhaps relates more broadly, perhaps, than just to individual generational descriptions. But if you're managing anyone, we should stop treating annual reviews or coaching or feedback as a primary engine for development. It's way too slow for anybody, and it's too abstract, and it's too low impact. One of the most important things when I think about this is to stop using corporate language. Be more proactive is not coaching. It is not developmental. It's confusing, and confusion creates anxiety, and anxiety reduces performance. We should stop making any kind of coaching or developmental experience performative. It shouldn't feel like a pantomime. People treat it like that, a one-off, an annual show, and it becomes meaningless. So what should we lean on? It's the things we've spoken about. Feedback loops, like regular check-ins, things that ask, what were your wins? What did you learn? What are you going to do better next time around? Why would that matter? How will it help you? We should also start trying to make any kind of growth opportunities real and tangible to people. No vague promises, real steps. So I like to offer outstretched projects. I try to find people mentors. I look to ensure that people get training and skill building they need. I look to expose people to decision-making and to the decision-makers. After what I said about Patagonia, I'd start encouraging anyone to think about peer-to-peer feedback. When we think about Gen Z or when we think about anyone else, everybody seems to respond well to community feedback and community learning. Peer input normalizes development and it makes feedback feel less of a top-down judgment, less done to, more an appreciated together. And that's why I think our team retros are really important and something that could be mirrored in other places. I think this is how you really grow people, not by polishing up some annual cycle, but by building a culture of actual personal development, coaching that supports real growth, coaching that supports actual performance, and that applies to every generation.
I agree. And there was a recent report by Deloitte's Gen Z research that also mentioned that coaching and growth and learnings are, these are the driving factors for where Gen Zs are, you know, where they want to work. I think there was something around there for work-life balance as well. Like Gen Zs, you know, in there somewhere, like you're prioritizing that. And that does make sense because right out of the uni, you don't have mortgages, you don't have kids, you don't have, you know, I mean, most cases, I don't.
We'll have one
day. Yeah. So the priority is feedback, setting yourself up for the future, I think. Yeah. What I did love about what you mentioned, and I relate to it heavily, I made a post about it on LinkedIn a few days ago, which went viral, thousands of likes. And the post was like, when you're reaching out to me, please don't reach out to me in a corporate language. Like, I know you don't talk like that in real life. No. So when people reach out to me, they're like, three paragraphs. Dear, if it's a junior, they say like, dear sir or dear Kunal, I hope you're doing well, which is all good, but it does look like no one talks like this in real life. There's no chance. Mm-hmm. It's like you're speaking in Times New Roman, you know. Mm-hmm. And most people who do get a faster reply from me, I mean, for folks who are watching, they know I have a big YouTube channel, decent following, so I get a lot of influx or messages. These are people who are to the point. Hey, Kunal, what's up? I'm doing this. Would you be interested? Cool. Done. So yeah. I do appreciate that. It just saves me a lot of time. And because I'm reading what I assume people are talking like, I find it easier to grasp that knowledge.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, you know, because if I'm reading something that I know it's not like someone is talking like this, then I would have to spend some time like, okay, what do you mean? Like, okay, three paragraphs. Just takes a lot of, I mean, it does take a lot of time.
Absolutely.
But I do agree with that. And I think coaching is definitely one of the driving factors for people. We're going to talk a lot more about that, like how we can better coach people. But I want to briefly jump on to our previous conversation around HR teams. I don't know how much Instagram do you use, how much TikTok you use, but HR departments have a lot of memes around them.
I'm so sorry, Janelle. I'm not neither. I'm a Luddite. I live in the past.
Yeah, it's all good. But there are a lot of memes around like HR teams. There's one popular meme, like there's one person walking confidently in a suit, and the caption says that when my joke was so hilarious, the HR team wants to hear it in person.
Mm.
Something like that.
Even the description makes sense. Yeah, I get it.
Yeah. So a lot of memes around that. And because there's also a report, you know, like Mercer's HR tech research that also suggests that a lot of teams do not feel very confident about getting the value from their HR tools. Why is that? Why do you think so many HR systems, you know, are like not resonating that well with the humans inside the company? Because correct me if I'm wrong, my whole understanding is it's more about your number one role is like communication and conversations, like helping people have better conversations. Resolving conflicts is one of those. So everything ties down to conversation. And since we spoke about feedback loops and growth and everything, that's also related to communication and setting expectations and everything. So why do you think that, you know, there's this image around HR tools? And is it HR tools that are not bringing that value? What are people doing wrong? And how can they basically, or is it not just about tools, or is it a bit of both?
It's a good question. And there's something interesting there, because when I think about the way that a lot of HR systems are designed, they're designed with compliance in mind. HR systems are designed to prove that a process has happened, and not necessarily designed to improve what happened between two people in that conversation you're talking about. So when I think about like traditional HR systems, they're optimized for auditability. Was this form completed? Was this rating submitted? Was this box ticked? Job done. But completion and compliance is not development. And those tools measure that one thing, but perhaps not the important thing. What we've spoken about, the actual conversation, the facilitation, and the outcomes that those conversations represent. There's also like a one-size-fits-all kind of problem. If you're boxed into using that standardized fixed template, same language, same cadence, same communication method, regardless of role, regardless of preference, regardless of person, or how you process any kind of feedback, then that's another problem. That's a devastating lack of personalization and a lack of adaption to fit the needs of the person going through the process. There are alternates. There are systems that support conversations, prompts that can help managers prepare, structures that encourage employees to ask for feedback or to reflect in the moment. If HR tech can help people think better and talk and learn better, it can earn that trust that we've seen and you've pointed out with memes is missing. And that trust in itself is pure value. If it only captures data, the process is meaningless, it's theatre. And this is why I think what Insights thinks about embedding human insights into the workflow really matters, because it can nudge that behaviour in that moment just when it can count most. So if we can adapt the tools that we use to meet the needs of the users, everyone gets an advantage. I understand you better. My communication for you is clearer. We connect. This idea of adapting a process with preferences, like I said at the start, was the reason I joined the company. I think there's huge gains to be made in this space for everybody. And if we can adapt, we can get to at least meet each other and support each other more effectively.
All right, Martin. So we'll talk about growth a bit more. And obviously, we're in the age of AI. I want to learn more about insights and how folks can get involved. But if you can ban like one review phrase forever. So something I hate is this needs to be more strategic, you know?
Yeah.
Something you would absolutely, you something that's your, like your ick and you don't like. a corporate phrase. Yeah. For reviews that doesn't really provide much value, you know. What would that be?
Yeah, I recognize where you're coming from, and one that I can remember from my early stages in my career was meets expectations. I can remember that was devastating because you're always striving for more. You're striving to exceed expectations, but meets expectations undercuts all the work that you've done through the space of the year. And I quite often remember seeing that across some of our performance reviews for us when we were junior in our careers. We would all just get the one phrase. And it felt disheartening. It felt that you were unseen. And that's something that I think we should desperately try to change. We should try and make sure that it's specific and personal to the person receiving it. Any feedback should be made for them, not for the form.
Amazing. Well, one last question around growth before we move forward to the next bit, Martin, is when we speak of growth, what does that actually mean? For Gen Zs, have you seen, does it mean you need more responsibility, more mentorship, you need faster feedback? How do you define growth?
It's a really strong question. And I think it's, again, it comes down to growth is specific to the person experiencing it. Across my team, I have 6 different people that report into me, and all of them grow in different ways, and all of them astonish me every day, week, month, quarter. And the growth isn't necessarily just in terms of their skill set, but in their adaptions and their behaviors within working across cross-functional teams. Insights is a pretty big company. It needs you to work across divisions like sales, it needs to work across operations, it needs to work across tech, it needs to work across legal, it needs to work across finance. And there are guys on my team that have marketing roles, they have sales roles, they have technical roles, they have PM roles. And the bit that I think is most impressive in terms of growth is their ability to communicate across all of these different divisions and to get outcomes that really matter from them. And I genuinely believe it's down to their ability to adapt to the needs of the people they're working with and to best absorb that information and understand it and consume it in a way that lets them turn it into something meaningful. I think the superpower of all my teams and the superpower in terms of their growth is their ability to adapt to fit. I think that's incredible.
Amazing. And obviously, we're living in the age of AI. AI is being used in education quite a bit. And we spoke about coaching quite a lot. And that's what you do, you know, at Insights. You have an amazing API that people can just tweak and plug in with their existing systems, and they can get all that information that you are giving about an individual, like their that helps in their performance review, basically idea about their personality that helps them in the future. So it's sort of like putting that power of AI in the hands of the HR team, the people team, your managers and whatnot. But with AI, you know, there's obviously like this question people have, like, where does the human come in? So if AI is doing the self-review for me, you know, where do I draw the line? Where is that handoff and what sort of a role is AI playing in coaching? And you're a really great person to answer this because you are, you know, you work at Insights and you are directly solving this issue. So do you get people asking that? And where do you see, even though you have this AI that gives you the personality of a person, let's say, where do you see an actual human come in to work with that API? Where do you bridge the line rather than, okay, I'm just going to let AI manage my whole work and expectations? Yep. You know, obviously there's a human involved because that's what makes it personal.
Mm. Yeah, completely. So when I think about this and I think about performance or outputs, AI changes for me what historically looked like high performance. AI can rapidly increase the volume of outputs for sure. You can be better, fitter, faster, more productive, way more quickly with AI. But I've seen that this volume does not represent value. And it's not a real demonstration of someone's applied understanding. Not that I see as yet, anyway. So when I think about AI, it makes outputs quicker and easier, and that's totally fine. It just means that the real work is more about choosing, more about testing, more about owning decisions. So when I coach my team, I look for values of their outputs, not the volumes of their outputs. And I have seen a few consistent problems in terms of the way in which AI has been applied. The one that always strikes me is paper-thin answers. So by this, I mean that I can see really high-end looking work that's been produced. But when we start to talk about it, there's very limited proof of understanding or of an indicator for me of what's being done with it. So I ask for the learning up front to try and counter this. I ask people to show me what they've ruled out and why they've ruled it out. What would change their minds and why? Where's the risk? What is the risk? Why did they get to this conclusion? Why did you reject others? Those kind of questions ensure that people are thinking about the learning in the process, not just in creating some artifact, but thinking about the meaning of what that artifact is and how it can be applied. One of the other things that I've seen is that AI pulls people towards the average. So you'll see safe, very familiar patterns and replies and responses when it's driven by AI. The telltale indicator of the M-dash, repeated framing conventions, any use of the words utilize or furthermore. AI makes approaches very tidy and very acceptable, but it waters down the outcomes of what people achieve. There used to be the saying that no one ever gets fired for choosing IBM. That's safe bet thinking. And I see that in a lot of AI-driven outputs. There's a real over-reliance on that safety net. It doesn't let you make a truly extraordinary discovery. It doesn't let you show really creative thinking, something that changes the way that we think or what we're actually going to make. So what I coach for when people are working with AI is, honestly, I coach for graft. How quickly my team find what matters to me. How quickly they separate the sludge from the gold, that matters. How that team learn to think beyond the AI outputs, that matters. So yeah, AI can help no end in terms of that. But value really comes from people, their attention, their intentions. That's what we should be coaching for. And that's where I see real value.
Yeah, I completely agree. And you mentioned that AI makes it easier, you know, to do day-to-day tasks. You mentioned that it makes people more efficient. Now, that's true. My question is, like, if AI makes work more easier, do expectations also quietly inflate? You know, what's like the fairest way to... So if you can do more, what is a fair way to reset the bar without burning people out?
Oh, that's a good question. So I've spoken about this before, and I don't necessarily care about the volume of outputs that people provide. I care about the value of the outputs they provide. So you might churn through way more research papers. You might be able to do an incredible lit review when you apply AI. But what I care about is the level of understanding that you've undertaken. You might only personally read one or two papers, but have a fair understanding about what something might mean or be. And you can present that back to me and we can make a decision based around that kind of input. Or you can have AI churn through 100 research papers and then get a generic output, but you can't explain it or apply it. What I really care about, and I don't care about volumes whatsoever, is I care about the ability to apply what you've learned and the gains that can make for the company. That's how I make sure that people don't burn out, because my expectation remains the same.
And also, since I'm, you know, implementing these AI tools in my company, with any AI tools, there's always a conversation around privacy. Are you using the data to train? And I don't want to give my sensitive data to someone. But then it's like an oxymoron, because you want to make the tool powerful. You want to make it like personalized. So how do you make it that powerful without dialing into the stereotyping and, you know, misuse of, or there's like a workplace or surveillance, you know? So my idea is like, for other companies out there who are planning to implement tools like this, let's say your Insights Discovery API, what would a responsible use look like for someone who wants to implement this organization-wide?
Okay, absolutely. Brilliant question. Completely on board. See where you're coming from. The most important thing when we think about any of this use of preference or personality type data, personality or preference type data, is that it's the individual that creates it, that has ownership over it. They choose what they allow to be out in the world. They choose what data they allow to be seen, and seen by whom, to what level. If you decide you don't want to engage with that data beyond your own understanding of what that preference might be, that should be perfectly acceptable. It shouldn't be something that's mandated or shared, because you own that data. You control how it should be used. And that brings like an ethical core to this concept. And if you get that right, we should always be designing in a way that we design for trust. So when I think about nudges, there's a principle that underlies how you build them, and that's called EAST, East. And I'm going to try and get this right. So in terms of this principle, E is for easy. We should remove any friction in the process of choice that we're talking about nudging. A is that we should make it attractive. We should shine the light on the potential of what we could achieve if the nudge was undertaken. S should be about the social elements of it. We should show what peers do and how that might influence the person undertaking the nudge. And T is about timely. You deliver a nudge at the right time, it has a massive impact. That's the operating guide for nudging. But then on top of that, we should layer in our ethical thinking. And this comes back to what we were talking about at the start. There's a freedom to choose. It should always be there to choose to opt in or to opt out. That's the very top of the tree. In all the partnerships we've worked on, this is the very first requirement we put in place. Any user at all chooses if their data is seen, if their data is shared. This is an option for them. Do you want your preferences to be taken into account? Yes or no? And we're transparent in all those things. This approach to personalization, it can't be hidden. We want people to engage with the process, how they choose to, and how that data is applied is down to them. And in order to avoid any kind of stereotyping, we always treat preferences as guidance. We never use it as a label, never use it as a label. It should be framed as preferences. This is a preference, not this is a definition of who you are. And to avoid people checking in and to avoid people snooping, we design for consent and with limit scope. People should know what is shown to whom and why it's shown and who can see it. As I said again, people should be at the controlling center of that. Responsible use for me looks like this. First up, consent and control. Opt in, opt out. Clear visibility and ability to revoke access at any point. And we should always apply the minimum viable dose. We should show practical tips, but we shouldn't go into any sensitive detail. And I would always separate any use of the tech from any high stakes decisions. We shouldn't be putting it in place for hiring. We shouldn't be talking about it in terms of promotion. We shouldn't be talking about it in terms of anything around discipline. It's a developmental tool, not a scoring tool. But if you build and use it in that way, it could be a hugely powerful force for empathy at scale. It can genuinely help people collaborate better. I've seen that happen. It can reduce friction, and it can make any kind of conversation much more human. This is our intent, to put people at the center of that workflow, people to be able to engage with each other at their very best, with support and with proper guidelines. So the tools support humans rather than replacing them.
I love how you end that supporting humans and not replacing them. Well, Martin, this was great. We covered a lot, and for folks who want to learn more about the Insights API, how to get started with it, the documentation is pretty cool. Check it out on the website. I'll be doing a tutorial. You can find that on my channel as well. My last question to you is, what's the best piece of advice you've ever been received?
If in doubt, even if only it's the most easy thing to remember, just tell the truth. It's the wisest bit of advice I've ever been given.